Hi, friends, and welcome to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, where each week we share an idea in the Parsha and how it relates to Jewish history, along with all the books and articles I've read over Shabbos to learn more about it. Just a reminder to sign up for our weekly email, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com, where you can find a write-up of our weekly class, along with all the links to the articles and books that I have discovered on my Shabbos reading journeys. Thank you so much to our friends and sponsors, Janet and Lior, Hode and family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. When I was in elementary school, the accepted way to ensure your promises were not binding was saying, "I promise," instead of "I promise." I'm 99% sure I learned this from my dear friend Yosef Moskowitz. This slight difference in pronunciation was deemed sufficient enough to make a promise no longer enforceable. "I said I promise," we would argue, a brilliant legal loophole within elementary school contracts. If only it were so simple. Parshas Matos introduces the actual concept of halachic promises known as nedarim. It is a strange concept to introduce at this moment in Jewish history. The Jewish people are on the precipice of entering the land of Israel. Moshe gathers all of the Jewish leaders, the Rosh Hamatos, the leaders of all the tribes, presumably to discuss the process of conquering the land and how it will be distributed. But first, Moshe introduces the concept of nedarim, Jewish oaths. Why now? Why is this so important before entering Israel that Moshe gathers all of the tribal heads of the Jewish people? Interestingly, the Torah only explicitly describes how a husband can nullify the oath of a spouse. Nullification of regular nedarim is not explicitly described in the Torah. In fact, the Mishnah in Chagiga describes the annulment of nedarim as hovering in the air without anything to support them. Heter nedarim, in the language of the Mishnah, parchim ba'avir ve'ein lahem al masha yismachu. Why of all the laws in the Torah are these the ones that have no allusion in the written Torah? And it is not even for lack of trying. The Talmud presents several approaches that find some sort of allusion for the concept of annulling vows, but each is ultimately rejected. It seems as if the Talmud doesn't even want to find an allusion for hataras nedarim, the nullification of vows. Why is this the one area of Torah law without a clear allusion in the written Torah? To better understand the uniqueness of the nullification of vows, let's explore the alternative Jewish movement known as Karaism, the Karaites, and their curious objections to Rabbinic Judaism, most notably vows. The first time most people are introduced to Karaites, they are not even being introduced to authentic Karaism. The term Karaite became a catch-all in rabbinic literature describing any heterodox Jewish movement that does not follow rabbinic law. As Frederick E. Greenspan writes in his fascinating article, "Sadducees and Karaites, the Rhetoric of Jewish Sectarianism," an awesome title. "The grouping together of all these anti-rabbinic movements was likely a deliberate rhetorical device of mainstream rabbinic leadership." He writes, "By painting these distinctive movements with the same broad brush, their opponents turn them into reincarnations of each other. Thus, medieval Karaism came to be seen as an outgrowth of the Sadducean heresy, the Tzedukim, which re-emerged a millennium later in the guise of reform. The repeated use of the terms elevates contemporary struggles to the realm of myth. The conflicts between the Pharisees, the Purushim, and the Sadducees, the Tzedukim, or the Karaites and the Rabbinites cease to be arguments that took place centuries ago, becoming instead a cyclical reiteration of a single recurring debate. As a result, this process bequeaths a kind of immortality to the Sadducees, the Tzedukim, and Karaites, who may be the ghosts of battles already fought and probably even won." So in 1844, when reformers gathered for a conference in Brunswick, it was a famous conference of all the reformers, Rav Moshe Schick, known as the Maram Schick, a student of the Chassam Sofer, he described the reformers as Karaites dressed in rabbinic clothes. subcult followers of Sabbateanism, Carr writes. An Israeli philosopher, Nathan Rottenstrich, even called Ben-Gurion's labor Zionist movement a new type of Karaism. So if these are, in fact, all different movements, Sadducees called Sadducum in rabbinic literature, Karaism reform, what exactly is the difference? The Sadducum, the Sadducees, were a Second Temple sect that we, in fact, know very little about. Rabbinic literature depicts their primary dispute with the Pharisees, who later became the torchbearers of rabbinic Judaism, as rooted in the question of, nope, if you guessed the oral law, you guessed incorrectly. It was rooted in the existence of the world to come, an afterlife. Most think the original initial hearsay was regarding the oral law, but in fact, in Avos to Rebbe Nasan, the way that rabbinic literature depicts the breakoff of the Tzedukim, the initial heresy of the Sadducees is the denial of an afterlife. Only afterwards did they take issue with the oral Torah. And just a little extra bonus, and I link to it, of course, in our weekly email, Reading Jewish History, theparsha.substack.com. If you want to read a really cool dream by Rav Tzadok, Rav Tzadok used to write down his dreams, and the Hasidic master, who I so often quote, born in 1823, died in 1900, he has a work that he writes all of his dreams. You can get it on Safaria. It's not translated, but in his final dream, the 27th dream, he actually presents the connection between the afterlife and the oral law in that fascinating dream. It is really worth reading, and you should check that out. Karaism emerged several centuries after the destruction of the Second Temple. Daniel Lasker, in his fantastic overview on Karaism, which benefited everything that we're sharing today, nearly everything comes back to his fantastic book. It has a primer, secondary sources, really, really interesting read. He dates the movement to the 9th century emerging in the Islamic Middle East. Many refer to Anan ben David as the founder of Karaism, though Lasker and other scholars note that this is not quite historically true. The way the story is normally told, Anan began the Karaite movement after being passed over to become the next exilarch, the Reish Galusa, a job that was instead given to his younger brother, Hananiah. Anybody who has a younger brother knows, you want to cause World War III in a family, favor the younger brother. It's not pretty. This story, while frequently retold, has scant historical basis. Anan was, in fact, the founder of a different movement known as Ananism, not to be confused. And I cannot stress this enough, you will thank me later. Do not confuse Ananism, which is the movement started by Anan ben David, with Onanism, a movement that I am begging you, don't even bother looking it up. While Karaism is preserved in our collective historical memory as an avowed foe of rabbinic Judaism, the level of adversarialness is overstated. In fact, as Lasker explains, life, however, is often stronger than ideology, and it would appear that even with their disagreement, relations with Karaites and Rabbinites were generally neighborly, and the borders between the movements were not impermeable. There are records of marriages between Karaite and rabbinic families, and even some who switch shuls, I love that, between Karaite and rabbinic synagogues. Honestly, if their davening is like, it's probably a lot shorter, but they probably spend a lot of time on laning. I don't think I'm going to join a Karaite shul just yet, but we'll talk a little bit about how their davening works in a moment. As opposed to the Tzedukim, Karaites did in fact believe in the afterlife and the world to come. Their debate with rabbinic Judaism focused much more narrowly on the existence of the oral law. Karaites, likely from the, why are they called that, from the Hebrew word karaim, like meaning those who read Mikra, the Bible, championed a more plain reading of the Torah without later rabbinic interpretation. They also did not include holidays such as Hanukkah, which took place after the canonization of Tanakh. Interestingly, the Karaites do celebrate Purim. Purim is forever. I'd be very bummed that. There's no way you're going to get a movement off the ground if you skip over Purim, even though the only book of Tanakh that does not appear in the Dead Sea Scrolls is Megillas Esther. But the Karaites are on board with Purim, even though it's not mentioned in the Torah. And here it is, they pray twice a day, not three times, twice a day from a liturgy that is basically mostly all from Tehillim, a little bit of Chumash, but they have a very different Shemona Esrei and prayer service than us. Judah Hadassi, one of the most renowned Karaite scholars of the 12th century, formalized Karaite belief. Instead of 13 principles, the Yud Gimel Ikarim, famously articulated by the Rambam, Maimonides, Karaites have 10 principles. Honestly, they're all more or less the same as those within Rabbinic Judaism, the only major difference being Maimonides affirming that belief in the divinity of the oral law is included as a central principle. Ironically, it was Rabbinic Judaism's polemic with Karaism that helped promote the very existence of Karaism. Much of Rav Yehuda HaLevi's Kuzari argues against Karaism, which the Kuzari attributes to a story that actually appears in the Talmud in Kiddushin when Yanai HaMelech persecuted Rabbinic Judaism. He said, the rabbis, you better get out of town. The only people who were left were those who only wanted to study the written law. And that, according to the Kuzari at least, is how Karaism was born. The most famous interlocutor, what an unnecessarily complicated word that I'm always excited to use, because it's just a great word, and you see other people using it, and you're like, when am I going to be the kind of person who can use the term interlocutor, which is like somebody who you're having a conversation with. The most famous interlocutor with Karaism is the Ibn Ezra, whose own more pshat-oriented approach to biblical interpretation both complemented and contrasted with the Karaite approach. In the Ibn Ezra's introduction to Torah, he cautions his readers to avoid the Karaite heresy, who he actually refers to them as Tzedukim, of denying the oral Torah. Despite their major ideological disagreement, Ibn Ezra does still cite Karaitic exegesis a few times in his own commentary. Not all anti-Karaite polemics and interactions are so clear. One fascinating case in point is the Rambam's organization of Hilchos Shabbos in his magnum opus, another word I always love using. Magnum opus. I wrote a mediocre opus. I'm still waiting to write my magnum opus. Magnum opus is a big deal. The Rambam's magnum opus, of course, is the Mishneh Torah. As Professor Chaim Soloveitchik notes in his article, Mishneh Torah, Polemic and Art. It's a beautiful article where he basically just marvels at the structure and idea behind Mishneh Torah. He writes, the structure of Hilchos Shabbos in the Mishneh Torah is deeply problematic. And, this is me speaking, you don't need to be an expert in Rambam or the laws of Shabbos to understand why. After providing a basic definition of the term melacha, prohibited creative works on Shabbos, one would expect the Rambam to then detail each of the 39 prohibited acts of melacha on Shabbos. Nope. Rambam instead dedicates the second chapter to the laws of pikuach nefesh, normally prohibited acts that are permitted in order to save a life. The next two chapters in the laws of Shabbos discuss warming food on Shabbos, followed by the laws of lighting candles on Shabbos. Rambam seems to have completely abandoned the sort of careful conceptual categorization that marks most of his other work. Why did the Rambam do that? Why did he structure Hilchos Shabbos so strangely? Just let me list the 39 melachos, then go through each one, and then we'll get into all the other stuff. Professor Soloveitchik offers a brilliant explanation. He writes, I now suggest that the reason for this cumbersome and counterintuitive arrangement is quite simple. The Karaite challenge. The Karaite injunctions against having any fire on Shabbos, even if it has been lit before Shabbos, or of having any cooking taking place on the Shabbos, even if it was begun before the Shabbos, are, of course, well known. Indeed, to Rabbinites, these restrictions became the popular litmus test of Karaism. Essentially, Professor Soloveitchik argues that Rambam's Hilchos Shabbos was deliberately structured in a way that would highlight the differences between Karaite and Rabbinic laws of Shabbos. While the differences between Karaite and Rabbinic Judaism as it relates to Shabbos is far more well known, one area of Jewish law really raised the ire of Karaite leadership, namely, you guessed it, that's why we're talking about it, the annulment of vows. As opposed to making vows, the annulment of vows is not explicitly mentioned in the Torah, except for a case of a husband annulling the vows of his wife. More specifically, Karaites took great offense at the Kol Nidre prayer said at the onset of Yom Kippur. Lasker cites Judah Hadassi, the aforementioned Karaite leader, is the one who came up, I think, with the Big Ten, the Ten Principles, who wrote extensively against Kol Nidre. Hadassi writes, "Is there any greater breach than this," referring to Kol Nidre, "for the ignorant? This is a great opportunity for those who wish to take false oaths throughout the year, constantly acting in this manner. They are of the opinion that with these words they will achieve atonement and will be forgiven each and every year forever." If they see that this is the case, according to your instruction, they will never repent from violating the commandment that one must observe and act according to the Lord's directives. Those who follow the annulment of vows, argues Hadassi, were the shepherds of the Second Temple period who misled the lost sheep, the Jewish people. Interestingly enough, in that 1844 conference in Brunswick, that Moshe Schick said that the Reform rabbis, he compared them to Karaites wearing rabbinic clothes. What did they vote on at that 1844 rabbinic conference? You guessed it, abolishing Kol Nidre. There's a lot more history about that. I'm pretty sure Avraham Fall Hirsch for many years did not say Kol Nidre because of some of these objections. But there's a lot of really fascinating stuff on this. Although Karaism is the oldest alternative to Judaism, its future is bleak. Without Talmudic interpretation, their rituals are actually much more rigid and have a harder time adapting to the changing circumstances brought with modernity. And as secularism and assimilation take hold in the Karaite world, their ability to distinguish themselves has gotten far more difficult. The longest surviving alternative form of Judaism, Lasker writes, may very well be in danger of having finally run its course. In our parsha, as the Jewish people stand on the outskirts of Eretz Yisroel, the land of Israel, Moshe gathers the leaders of the Jewish people and explains the laws of Nedarim. If someone pledges to God, Moshe tells them, they shall not break this pledge. All that is articulated from your mouth must be carried out. It's a strange law, as we mentioned previously, to emphasize in this moment. Why introduce Nedarim on the doorsteps of the conquest of the land of Israel? Because, Moshe understands, language is how human beings build society. As I once wrote in an essay on Tractate Nedarim, it's part of a larger project for Tablet Magazine where I write thematic essays at the end of each tractate, each mesechta, along with Daf Yomi. I happen to be incredibly proud of that project. And if you would indulge me and sign up for our weekly emails, reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com. You better believe I'm going to plug that again. Of course, I have a link to both Tablet and my academia page where I have the essay starting from Brachos all the way to Bava Metzia, where the Daf Yomi, the most recent Masechta that was completed by Daf Yomi. And in that essay on Nedarim, I wrote as follows, and a lot of this is paraphrased from there. Language in tracking Nedarim is not descriptive. It is transformative. Objects, relationships, even religious obligations can be reimagined through the linguistic power of the neder. This is an important departure from how we normally understand language. Early scholars of language, such as St. Augustine, thought language was just about corresponding objects to the words they represent. Point to a bird, say bird. Language creates a correspondence between word and object. Later scholars, such as Wittgenstein, thought of language as more of a game. We learn language through playful and creative usage. According to this theory, language may not correspond at all to any actual reality, but the meaning of words is a product of how we use them. Tractate Nedarim and the very concept of the Neder subverts our notion of language. Instead of words corresponding to reality, words have the power to reshape reality. A loaf of bread becomes a sacrifice. Like the Gemara constantly says in Nedarim, Konam alai kikar zeh. And this is precisely the power denied by the Karaites. How can the Jewish people create and dissolve, so to speak, their own prohibitions? Only God has such power. But the notion of nullification of vows is actually the reminder that we, the Jewish people, through the power of the Oral Torah, have the capacity to fashion worlds with our words. Yuval Harari, in his magisterial, though sometimes cynical book Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, places the transformative power of language at the heart of human history. Other animals may communicate, but humanity's language is different. All other animals, he explains, use their communication system only to describe reality. Monkeys point to food. Gazelles signal an approaching predator. Birds look for a suitable climate. Humans alone, argues Harari, transform reality with their language. We tell stories about our reality that reshape reality itself. Countries, currency, even religious life do not correspond to the physical differences in the realia of the world we inhabit. And this has been the secret of humanity's survival. As Harari explains, we can cooperate flexibly with countless numbers of strangers because we alone of all the animals on the planet can create and believe fictional stories. And as long as everyone believes in the same fiction, everybody obeys and follows the same rules, the same norms, the same values. A fictional story isn't necessarily wrong or even untrue. It is simply a reminder that language has the power to ascribe meaning, to sanctify, and to reframe the physical world, even when everything tangibly remains the same. This is the power of a neder. To you, it's a loaf of bread. To me, it's a sacrifice. To you, it's 8,500 square miles in the Middle East. To me, it's my ancestral homeland. Countries, borders do not correspond. They don't correspond to anything in reality. This is where the United States ends. This is where, you know, Brazil, Mexico, Canada, Israel. Countries are born out of this power of language, which is why it's specifically now that Moshe reminds the Jewish people of the power of language before conquering Eretz Yisrael. Wittgenstein himself understood this as well. Can only those hope who can talk, the philosopher asked, acknowledging that the transformative power of language, reshaping reality, creating the true fictions that bind us together, may also hold the key to our future. Only those who have mastered the use of the language, Wittgenstein continued, can see beyond the plain reality of the world, bananas, terrain, mountains, and climates, and instead reshape a world with countries, nationalities, sanctity, and all those unseen, invisible concepts that elevate the human experience toward the divine. Language creates hope. And perhaps this is the transformative power of Kol Nidre and why it serves as the introduction to the entire Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. If Nidarim isn't so much about vows as it is about the transformative power of language, maybe Kol Nidre too isn't so much about annulling our promises, but reflecting on the worlds we've created with our words. All those words that shape our worlds, I'm a loser, I'm no good, it's going to fail, it'll never change, it'll never get better. We begin Yom Kippur by annulling those ugly words of our past and hope for a future with new words and worlds. Kol Nidre, all those words that deplete, self-sabotage, create distance, we ask, we plead to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, let's find new words to reshape our world. So thank you again for listening to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha. To get the links to all the articles, books mentioned, be sure to subscribe to our weekly Substack, Reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com. Thank you again to our sponsors, Jana and Lior Hode, and family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. Thank you so much for listening, and keep reading each and every Shabbos.